Boom, what up? Hello, bonjour, and hola, real leaders. This is Kevin Edwards, your host here, and I am so excited you're tuning in to one of our amazing experiences. What you're about to hear is going to be fresh, real, and loaded with inspiration, guaranteed to support your impact journey. So sit back, enjoy the listen, folks, share a review afterward, and always keep it real.
In 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Real Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Edwards. Alongside me today, folks, get the CEO and founder of Mast Reforestation. Please give a warm welcome to Mr. Grant Canary. Grant, thanks for coming on the show today.
Hello, hello. It's a pleasure.
Fantastic. Grant, I'd just love to dive right into it. I think this is going to be an eye-opening conversation for many folks listening to the program today. And I think the topic could kind of, it will evolve around carbon credits, will evolve around a for-profit solution to what could be, an existential problem. And so before we kind of talk about the solution, Grant, I want to kind of go into your background. Okay, your origin story. Like, where were you prior to this when you came up with this idea?
So I built a company out of Bogota, Colombia. It was focused. It was my master's thesis, as well as a company. So, you know, kind of hedging my bets there. Most startups don't make it. I'll get a master's thesis out of it as a minimum. That was at Universidad de La Sabana. And it was taking food waste and feeding it to insects in their larval form, also known as maggots, and turning that into industrial insect protein. And why would you do that? Well, from a sustainability perspective, we're bankrupting the world's oceans of the smallest fish species to feed farm fish. So if we could take a waste product that we waste a lot of food for good reasons, sanitary and bad reasons, and turn that into a more sustainable product fish already eat flies. So take them in their larval stage, grind them up, cook them, and turn them into industrial protein. That is a win-win-win, and alleviates a lot of pressures off of our oceans. So built that up, was acquired. And under the acquirer, we built a 6,000 square foot pilot and then scaled that up to a 60,000. So for some people, that sounds like something out of Saw, of like 60,000 square feet of maggots. But like, this is where sustainability really took us there. And looking at that from there, really want to do something more on mitigating the worst effects of climate change. That's where I spent my entire career, whether it's U.S. Green Building Council or wind energy on three continents or sustainable protein. So got into, okay, I'm going to go to the drawing board and figure out what can I do to pull carbon out of the atmosphere? And that's a really difficult journey. So for folks who are in that, I went through a number of different sort of sprints on different ideas, and it's a difficult process. So empathy out to you on that, and happy to share more if that's a useful part of the journey.
Wow. So fresh out the gate, you know, into sustainability, into, you know, growing a business to intentionally take on these issues with a for-profit model and scale these solutions. Now into the carbon market sector, what were some of the original ideas? You just said, hey, I got empathy. For anyone listening out there who's tested this, what are some of the original ideas and where did you land?
I had some really, some terrible ideas. And the reason I said it's painful is like, this is lean startup, right? So the original sort of book that kicked off kind of product management. I would share these ideas with friends and they would be like, no, don't do that. I don't want to pay for that. I don't want that product to exist in the world. In other cases, it was like, well, it'd be totally fine, except for somebody's going to come in and absolutely eat your lunch within a heartbeat. I mean, example of that is I looked at it. This was 2014, 2015. I looked at, okay, it's going to take 40 minutes to maybe an hour to charge an electric vehicle. What would a good electric vehicle charging experience look like? And often you look for like, well, what's a bad experience look like? Well, a lot of people for gas stations, like food's not healthy. Bathrooms are not known to be clean. The like customer service usually leaves a little to be desired. The whole like grounds are usually kind of gross and oily. And so like, oh, wow. Like I was like, oh, it'll have clean food. It'll have Wi-Fi. It'll have, you know, you could sit and you could do your emails. Well, I was like, congratulations. Like you've just invented a Starbucks. And that to me was like a very obvious, like they will come in and take you out in a heartbeat. And so that was something that looking at that, was like, all right, well, I don't think I'm going to go that direction. And I still think that like, with Electrifying America and Starbucks, like I want to see them make, you know, make more, take more activity faster there. There were some other ideas that I, you know, again, people told me like, I don't want to pay for that. I don't want to buy that. So, what that led to was, a conversation where a friend was joking with me and was like, well, I guess you're going to go plant trees as the, you know, de facto or the like, this is the way you get carbon out of the atmosphere. And I had, you know, how did I get to Colombia, the country? I had been part of a very large tree planting project, 30 in-house consultants, 30 out-of-house consultants hired by JP Morgan to figure out how much it would cost to scale up a 20-year United Nations pilot project that had been very successful in reforesting the northeast of the country, 20,000 plus acres, if memory serves here. And so we wanted to turn that into, you know, 5x that, and that starts to look like national park size. And that project didn't go through, but I was really impressed with the levels of automation and equipment that they had there. So I was looking at it and was like, I wonder what, you know, our my home country, the US, looks like as far as reforestation. I was really bummed to see that a lot of it was just very manual. And really wanted to think about, okay, well, how do we scale this to a much greater degree? And so that's really where we got started, there.
You know, you kind of strike me as the entrepreneur who really likes to reimagine how things are done, you know, can look at something and see a different version of itself, you know, in purest form, an innovator, right? Innovation can come from multiple different areas. What do you think like forces innovation, would you say, in your experience?
I think it's identifying like what are those challenges, what's solving the customer problem, both the ones they know they have and the ones that they might not know that they have. I mean, one useful lens for that is sort of the aspirin problem or the candy problem. Like people pay a lot of money for an aspirin when they have a headache. People aren't necessarily guaranteed to pay for candy. So it's something that like along those lines, like are you solving a problem or a headache, or are you providing a nice to have that may or may not take off in the market? So if we look at, you know, we can look at that in the same way that we've looked at landowners that are impacted by wildfire. I mean, what does mass reforestation do? Essentially, the headache problem is that the landowners have been impacted by wildfire. What the problem that is not obvious is that historically, wildfires have, after, you know, what I was taught in high school bio, forest burns, forest regrows. Well, we're seeing, due to climate change, that acceleration of the size and the severity of fires, the severity meaning that it's burning much hotter, much deeper into the soil, much the entirety of the tree, not a portion of the tree. Those forests are not regenerating nearly to the extent that they previously did. And so, great, what are the landowner choices if natural regeneration dropped for, let's say, greater than 90% to precipitously lower than that, 40, 50, depends on the ecosystem. I've got a caveat pretty hard there. All of a sudden, well, nature doesn't do a vacuum. So what's going to grow there? If you've got this, a lot of the topsoil's gone because it burned off. That's the black in those big clouds after a wildfire. A lot of that is carbon. So invasive species are more likely to, you know, are very often what comes back. Invasive species, unlike natives, their evolutionary like propagation strategy is spray and pray, like put all the, you know, little seeds out there and grow. But that means that they're not adapted to the natural landscape. So they don't retain moisture through the dry season. So they're much more likely to dry out in the dry summer months. and they're a liability. They're more likely to burn. Okay. So, okay. So option one is, you know, the sort of do nothing option is one thing that a landowner can do. The option two is you can sell, but a lot of the land's value is in the trees themselves. Third option is you can pay to reforest it. If you're reforesting for timber and you're looking at the Western 11 states, much of the eight inland states, it's going to be a couple million bucks for a couple thousand acres to reforest. And it's going to take 60 to 85 years for those trees to grow. If you account for the sort of compounded interest of the time value of money, like that analysis is negative. Like any financial advisor would be like, put your money into like almost literally anything else because your return here is not worth it. So what we do and how we solve that problem is we offer reforestation at no upfront cost. And the way we can do that is we have carbon credits. There we can get into like what is the type, what is the methodology, who's the third parties, etc. But there is a carbon credit that is generated by reforesting and certified, and that collateralizes a project finance loan. So we can come to the landowner and say, look, we're gonna take care of all of the headaches. Where does the seed come from? Where is it grown in a nursery into a seedling? How are we going to get it out to site and how are you going to pay for it all? We'll get a project done in 3 years and we'll equitably split the return with you. It's all going to be financed by a loan that's collateralized by carbon credits. And so that's really the product that we offer. And then we're looking at how we solve additional problems in that supply chain as well. So that's a lot. I'll dig in there.
Yeah, I'm gonna dissect that as best as I can. I think it's really important for folks listening out there, especially the layman who are like, you know, why don't we have solutions? Yeah, well, the environment, unfortunately, you know, it doesn't have cash, right? It can't pay you for all the great things that Grant wants to do to it, right? So I liked how you started the innovation about, you know, the topsoil, but then really dig into, okay, who's paying for this? Well, it might be the landowner, right? The landowner that also wants to, you know, the value of the property is the timber that they have for selling to loggers in the area. I'm from the Northwest, very familiar, you know, with you know, that neck of the woods, of course, the fires that go all the way up to British Columbia. And it's a big issue, of course, now down here in California, you know, huge, huge issue. But what is driving someone to take out money and actually finance these operations? You say we can do it through the carbon credit markets, right? Through the carbon credit markets. So as collateral. So maybe dive into that a little bit more. Explain to me and layman out there, like, what are the carbon credits? How is this seen as collateral? Who finances this?
Yeah. Okay. I'll head there, but I'll make one like sort of top level point here, which is like,
yeah.
For the layperson out there, I mean, nature absent cash, it's like we're sort of relying on altruism to reforest because it's a couple million bucks for a couple thousand acres and not going to see a return. So for a landowner perspective, why would they do that? Well, they don't have any good options without this, which is like allow a, you know, flammable liability to grow on your property or sell it. And a lot of people don't want to sell. You know, they've been, families' land's been in the whether it's a tribal nation or a small family forest or otherwise, like those are sort of generational lands. So, okay, that caveat made. Carbon credits. Who, you know, where does the money come from? I mean, what's probably helpful to start off with is just what we do, and then we can kind of circle back to carbon credits as a whole. And where does that sort of fit in the structure of carbon credits? So what we do is what very like many people would recognize from U.S. Green Building Council or from other sort of third-party certification of electronics or otherwise, which is we follow a methodology. It's created by a nonprofit. This is Climate Action Reserve that they utilize other third parties to verify. We will go in and we will plant seedlings. These are with seed used from as close to the fire as possible because, and we collect that seed because it will be adapted to the site. We grow it in our nursery and then we pay for the labor to get out there to site. It has to wait a year for, you know, through the tree has to live through the dry season, the summer. And then a third party forester the accreditations depend on the state, comes out and does sampling methods across several thousand acres to say, hey, what's the, do we have the species at the right density? We plant at a much lower density. There's not perverse incentives to sort of stock this as tightly as possible. Those densities are a lot more like natural densities. Do we have the right species? We plant a polyculture or multiple species. That adds additional fire resilience because different species have evolved with fire in different ways. And so they send those results off to Climate Action Reserve. Climate Action Reserve is like, great, based off of the species mix, based off of the density. This is how much tonnage will be of carbon will be pulled out of the atmosphere over the next 100 plus years. So that's a forward-looking credit. That's what's really helpful in that regard. And how can we make those estimations? Well, we can make those estimations because, one, we've been studying trees for 200 plus years, and the industry is, whether it's coming from the academic or the public or the private sector, is very good at saying, like, okay, based on this plot of land, this soil, how many 2x4s do we expect to get out of the, you know, out of the trees? Like, well, that's their economic analysis, or there's a, you know, very established body of science for that. Similarly, the trees that are not burned are within some distance nearby, and those tree rings are giving a written data record of how fast do they grow, and that can be converted instead, you know, board feet per acre into tons of carbon. And so that data can all be calculated, and then as the trees grow, what we can see over time is we can go out and validate those and convert those from a forward-looking credit to a credit that has been attained. And that forecast is fairly conservative. So there's a high likelihood that what we'll see is we'll see greater and greater credits issued after the fact. So that's kind of how we operate. There's some other pieces of things that we do. There's a lot of standing dead biomass after a fire. That's also a fire risk. People can think about it as like, what's the easiest way to start a campfire? It's to use the old log. So there's a lot of old burned logs after a wildfire where that biomass hasn't been fully consumed. And so that's something that we're similarly like having discussions on, how do we manage that? It's one of our biggest costs in the reforestation industry.
Interesting.
So I can pause there, and we can go into kind of the taxonomy of credits if that's helpful.
Before we do that, simplify to me what one credit equals. You mentioned carbon emission, like CO2 tons. Tell me, like, what does one credit equal?
A ton of CO2 equivalent. And under Climate Action Reserve, that's how much will be captured over the next 100 plus years as the trees grow.
And like a commodity like gold, silver, is this market a new asset? Is that how it's seen, a new asset class, as I can invest into one ton of carbon dioxide removed, and that is one credit for me? Is that a similar kind of way to look at this?
Yeah. So we look at the markets where we're headed is we are figuring out, it's like gap accounting just got invented for carbon. Okay. And what I mean by that is like historically you look back and like around like, you know, you can look back at different periods of US history and like, we didn't have standardized accounting methods. So, which is sort of a wild concept. You're like, whoa, actually that seems like it would have been hugely problematic. Yes, it would. We are now sort of seeing with regulation today, the emergence of three accounting standards: California, the SEC, and EU. The EU 10,000 US companies of a large size will be required for the first time this year to disclose what their emissions were in their scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions. And so you can kind of get into the scope 1, the scope 2, and scope 3. The scope 3 is really the like use of those products. And that's highly political because if you're sort of considering the companies like travel and data centers, the emissions may not be very high. But if your company manufactures cars and those cars are burning like carbon and sending it up in the atmosphere, all of a sudden those emissions get much higher. So that's where we're starting to see those rules get created. And the sort of obvious thing is, it's like, okay, well, if your products make a big mess, are you cleaning it up? And most people would expect that. And it's pollution. And if your products pollute, like if you pollute a river, are you cleaning it up? Are you doing anything about it? If you're causing people to have asthma, if you're, you know, all of those things, that's something that we're now starting to see. You know, first step is like, well, let's measure it. And most companies have not, let's say, let's call it a good portion of companies have never made any disclosures on their carbon emissions. So that's now going to change. And it's going to be according to one standard, meaning that, and it's not in the marketing department where you can walk away and be like, oh, that's maybe we don't want to report that this year. This is all of a sudden in the shareholder compliance world, where if you don't follow the accounting standards and disclose, like, you can get sued by shareholders. And you know, why is that important? Well, you can see in some worlds where different companies have made different disclosures, and they're like, well, that seems way out of whack. That company is way bigger, but they're saying their carbon emission disclosures are smaller. Well, in one instance, like, they didn't account for their employees' transit to work, and the other company did, and all of a sudden that has a huge impact. So these are some of the things that, like, start to get ironed out pretty quickly as far as, like, all right, how are we doing this, everyone, and what does that mean as far as, like, responsibility?
Right. And I think where Grant is getting at is this, the emergence of this asset class being carbon credits, and why it is on the rise as seen in the EU. The disclosure of your carbon emissions can impact risk from an investment standpoint. And so if I'm reading that right, you know, that could also, that now it hasn't gotten to the United States, or at least legally, and there will be, you know, legal action to, you know, mitigate that. But, you know, we're not there yet. It's coming. It's potentially coming. And that could influence, you know, the risk on loans, even if you're a small business owner or a publicly traded corporation. So, how do you mitigate that now? Well, one way would be through buying carbon credits, right, to mitigate your risk, and also to provide back to the environment that you that your business is creating externalities for. So we're back to this conversation. You had said that there is a taxonomy for carbon credits. Tell me a little bit more about what you mean.
One note to what, please, you said. The small business is very unlikely to be affected in the immediate term. So for people who are like, I already have too much stuff to comply with, totally get it. This is for very profitable businesses over a certain size. And California passed that legislation. So if you're doing, you know, if you're a very large business and you sell in California, and again, over a certain size and hurdle, then it's likely that that will be something that will go forward this year, because it's, those businesses already have to comply with the EU, and the SEC was the first one out the gate to pass this, have a rule proposed and accepted comments, and that is similarly likely.
What is the size of the company, Grant, and for California?
There's a Wall Street Journal article, 10,000 US companies in the EU. So those are, like, obviously those are, like, over a certain size. I don't have off the top of my head what the size is, but this is something that, like, hey, the businesses that have the capital to figure this out, like, that's sure, where this is, you know, if you can hire Deloitte, you can, you're probably you're got probably going to be doing some reporting.
I'm there. Okay, taxonomies.
Yeah, so taxonomies. All right, so I want to speak to, like, directly to the audience. It's like, yeah, I watched John Oliver, and, like, I, you know, heard carbon credits are BS, and, like, okay, let's give, like, more nuance to that, because carbon credits aren't one thing. And there are absolutely some deserved criticisms of different types of carbon credits, but ecosystem marketplace, there's 170 plus types of carbon credits coming from 100 plus companies. So this is everything from avoided deforestation, like, we probably shouldn't cut down the rainforest, to more efficient cook stoves, meaning that for communities in which cutting down nearby trees and shrubs and other things to have cooking fuel is a source of, like, effectively deforestation, like, this is relevant. and so on and so forth. So there are 170 different plus types. You heard me describe significantly like where ours fits. This can also be in management of different gases, and you know, the list goes on. There's those 170. There's the compliance market. There's the voluntary market, and then there's like the nation state. So these are sort of the three big buckets. The nation state, you got COP, you've got they're complying with like what's the US's emissions versus what pledges are being made. And if a large tech company is reducing their emissions, does the United States get credit for that or not? And there's people who are having those discussions. You've got the compliance market, which is effectively a tax. If you're polluting, you've got to pay a tax. So if you're in a highly polluting industry like airlines or oil refining or other things like that, like, well, we're going to charge you for your emissions and we're going to do exactly what we did with the hole in the ozone layer. We're going to create a cap and then start to squeeze that cap down so there's less and less pollution. And then there's the voluntary market, which where we live. So voluntary market is 1 to 2 billion, compliance is 900 billion plus. There's a compliance market in California, Washington, the Northeast with Reggie. You've got Canada that just passed one. You've got several European markets as well. Where we live is in the much smaller voluntary market and where a lot of people are seeing a lot of promise because there is both the, hey, we shouldn't cut down the rainforest, but we really need to have some accountability standards around that. And those are getting tightened up. And then there's also the removal space. And the removal space is what are the technologies where we're going to pull carbon out of the atmosphere? And that's where reforestation sits. And it sits alongside of coastal capture. It sits alongside of chemical processes, lime, direct air carbon capture, others along those. It sits alongside biochar. So these are sort of like the removal technologies where we have already emitted so much carbon into the atmosphere that if humans were just magically gone tomorrow as a thought experiment, all of the ecosystems would go through all the fundamental changes of climate change in a negative way. And so we, in the same time that we need to be stop emitting, stop filling up the bathtub, we also need to have a drain in which we can take things out of the bathtub. And so that's where removals really, really fit.
Got it. Okay. And so when you're saying that the nation state compliance market and voluntary markets, you're living in the voluntary markets, people saying, okay, we're pretty forward thinking. We want to make sure that we're, you know, offsetting. And how does this company, what you already kind of explained the types of companies, how does this company partner with you to then go back to that landowner to make sure that we can finance his reseeding?
Yeah. Well, we know that good things are coming from reforestation, right? We've got the trees pulling carbon out of the atmosphere, and now we got to measure it. And we talked a little bit about how to do that, converting the 2x4s into tons. There's other removal technologies that don't have the luxury of like 200 plus years of background science and trees as available data set. And they're figuring that out. Coastal capture, biochar, others, right? So there's a needs to be a unit of measure, and that's that tons of CO2 equivalent that we mentioned there. So then the next piece is okay, well, there are a number of other services, ecosystem services being provided by a forest. And right now, landowners were relying on that altruism. They're just expected to reforest out of the goodness of their heart, millions of dollars into these thousands of acres that have burned because they, you know, want it to look pretty. Like that's, you know, awesome that they would do that, but we're going to need a lot more people motivated to do that, which, you know, one of the best ways we can motivate people is resource them with capital to do that and provide a return to be the caretaker and stewards of that land. And so that's really where this comes in. And the other ecosystems that are services that we, you know, talked about, biodiversity there, trees at the right density, a Goldilocks density, not too many, not too few, increase the amount of water that flows downstream. Too few trees, the soil isn't shaded, and so it evaporates out, the water evaporates out. Too many, the trees are acting like a pump, and all of that biomass up top is like wet t-shirts on a clothesline, just breathing out that moisture. That's why if you're on a hot day and you're in the shade of a tree, like it feels cooler. Yes, it's the shade, but it's also there's like moisture around there. So depends on the tree, how much it's breathing out. But that gives you an idea there. And then there's other credits that that are ecosystem services as well that we think about. And there's models for how we're doing that. So those are some of the things that, you know, we need a unit of measure. The first one is on carbon. We need to get that so that it's a capital or amount of money going to landowner. Where does that come from? That comes from somebody who's buying that unit of measure, that ton of carbon, and then we're still figuring out the metrics for biodiversity. Inch acres of water would be Blue Forest Conservation's metric for water. So those are some of the pieces there. And we can talk about why they would buy that ton in the voluntary market, and then what that sort of portends for the future.
Well, I think it makes sense in the voluntary market. Let's just take Unilever, for example. You know, like if they want to offset their carbon emissions, would they just go directly to you and say, hey, I need my emissions I'm putting into the atmosphere. Let's just take a broad number, 100,000 carbon, dioxide tons going into the atmosphere. Would they go directly to you and say, hey, and then you say, okay, so then, okay, guys, so then do you say, hey, here's the price per carbon emission ton. And then they offset that way and they just go through you. Is it as simple as that?
Yep. That's how it works. We can also work with other different exchanges, whether they're focused on some of the other types of buyers that are out there that are looking to satisfy that. And really what where that price sits, you can see anything from, $30, $40, $50 up to, $2,500, for direct air carbon capture. So for folks who are deeply suspicious of like, hey, it seems like, it costs me, this much for a gallon of gasoline, a couple bucks. And then it's like really cheap to pull that ton out of the atmosphere. I think that like, yes, that is what is emerging, is that like pulling a ton of carbon out of the atmosphere is a process that costs more than a couple of bucks. If you're protecting the rainforest, that absolutely should be done. And it can be done because you're verifying something that has already happened. That is preserving and protecting the rainforest or a forest that carries a different price point as far as what it costs to implement. But for reforestation, it's a couple million bucks for a couple thousand acres. And that money's got to come from somewhere because natural regeneration is declining. So we either just sort of give up and say, hey, yeah, 750 million acres in the US, like feel free to burn. We'll sort of hope for the best. To give you an idea of what that surrender would look like, one wildfire a year in California in 2020, estimates are that it emitted more carbon. I think 120 million plus tons. I have to check the article, is in the LA Times a while back, but the 18 years of prior policy wins in California was far surpassed by that one wildfire season, meaning changing California's fuel mix and other things along those lines. Like, that's how much carbon goes up. And if we just sort of say, we're not even going to try to reforest that, we'll just let it go. That's a huge disservice to mitigating the worst effects of climate change. So that's just something as far as like how people think about that.
It makes a lot of sense. And there's a growing sentiment of this, not that it hasn't already been there, but of course escalated now with social media and the rise of, the Me Too movement of, hey, I'm trying to raise a family in this next generation. And, businesses are, at least in their perspective, really socializing these costs that people have to pay their externalities. What is the price per carbon that you charge? Does that fluctuate on a month-to-month basis, on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so the market is growing and establishing, and you could see for a reforestation credit, like a 30 to, I'm going to give like broad ranges here, like a 30 to 50. And for other types out there, you can see a couple $100 because it costs more to do the activity. And so those are some of the pieces. But I think the other like really important thing that should be acknowledged about what we do that's different is the supply chain for reforestation has been completely overwhelmed. And what I mean by that is, so we bring a vertically integrated supply chain. What I mean by that is if you could rely on nature to regenerate most of the time, then you didn't need a huge supply chain, except for when you needed to comply with state laws that said when you cut a tree, you have to replant a tree. Well, if all of a sudden nature stops regenerating in anything like remotely close to what was historical, and just to give you an idea, like Tom Porter was on 60 Minutes. California's state fire chief. He's like, look, it used to be that a career wildfire used to be 10,000 acres. Meaning like something that you would see once in your career as a wildlands firefighter. Now, obviously, like now we're seeing million acre plus, we're seeing it takes 100 to 200,000 acres to like make the news. And so you see that the, you know, change and you say, okay, well, where's the, when you have a high severity fire, a lot of the seed that's in the soil and in the crowns of the trees gets torched. So where's that seed going to come from? Great. Now you've got the seed. If you've solved that problem, now you need greenhouses to grow it into a seedling, and then you need labor to get it out to site. So, I mean, we've made two acquisitions, Silva Seed, where we manage majority of the Western 11 states conifer seed on behalf of ourselves and our landowner clients. And then there we acquired CalForest, which grows the majority of California's trees. And I know that a lot of times, like startups, like overrepresent on that. But the, you know, CalForest acquisition here is like the majority of California trees is an understatement. And so, like, really excited to be, you know, we grow for U.S. Forest Service, we grow for Cal Fire, we grow for large timber producers. So on that basis, like looking to how do we grow that supply chain? To be able to reforest so that people have access to clean air, enough water, cold water for fish, and so forth.
Impressive what you guys have done. Again, congratulations on the growth. It's no small feat. I want to go back to what you just said, though, and ask a real question. I don't know if anyone, if there's an answer for it, but, you know, I think I read a stat that there's more trees today than there's ever been, you know, throughout the history of time. And climate change is still fighting. It's still growing. It's still continuing. And we're seeing fires we've never seen before. Now, I get, you know, the planting that you're doing is going to mitigate a lot of that, those fires based on the, you know, the diversity of the roots and the plants that will grow around it to reduce its you know, openness to fires, I guess. But question for you, let's say this goes through, right? It goes through with the United States. Multinationals now have to get taxed for, you know, this and offsetting their carbon emissions. Your business is going to boom. This whole market will boom, let's say. Is it still going to have an impact on climate change?
It's an all hands on deck. So I would say that, like, let's just be very clear and transparent that, like, trees are not a silver bullet. They're not going to end climate change. There has to be a reduction in emissions. There has to be other technologies, nature-based or engineered. So you mentioned learning from the Me Too movement. This is a learning from the AIDS movement. How do you bring into the public consciousness that, like, hey, we absolutely need to be doing something, and it's deeply, deeply important. One of the principles there in that movement was accepting all forms of good faith action and emphasizing the need for action. And that is what was catalytic into into bringing that into public consciousness. And for us, that's for mitigating, how do we mitigate the worst effects? And I think that, like, as far as the positioning of that as well, thinking about it, like, what motivates me personally is not going to be what motivates other people's. And what I mean by that is, like, a student of history, I am deeply, deeply concerned about a future that looks a lot like the Dust Bowl, or that looks like, for a less Eurocentric example, the Great Hunger in China, where more people died due to drought and malnourishment than in the Holocaust. No one knows because of the estimates, but that was a massive, massive cost of human life. And if you look at that, and it was bad land use planning and it was a drought, that is a huge, like, that is where we're headed on a global scale. I deeply am deep. I'm deeply concerned by that. And from that basis, like, I see that as something where our political, our economic, and our social systems like come grinding to a halt. And so, you know, what works for me as far as like the things that motivate me is like, I think about climate change as a problem that all other problems report to. Not because other problems aren't important. We can agree that there's a ton of problems we would all like seeing changed or otherwise like an improvement to. But if people are wondering where their food's going to come from, how the political system is going to hold up, what the economy is going to do, et cetera, as we've seen really dramatically over the last 3 years, as a result of systemic climate change, like they're not worried about how to like resolve cancer or how to better educate people and in schools, et cetera. They're much more in sort of the survival mode. And that's what I'm deeply concerned about. Now, that's the like negative pitch. Let me like hard cut to like the positive pitch. That's the like taxes, it will be bad, like, et cetera. The like positive pitch is like, holy crap, like we can have this amazing future in which like we have electric cars, we have electric tractors. We just bought our first electric tractor. We can have these like transit systems, whether they're biking or walking or walkable communities or high-speed light rail or otherwise like more sustainable aviation that are diminishing asthma, that are diminishing and starting to make a much more like bright and foreseeable future. And that's where I want people to go, is like, what are the things that they want to build and be excited about in the future of the world? And what I can share, and I'm going to lose a couple people here, but I'm going to go there, you know, hang out for 1 second. Like, imagine, okay, we have this carbon market and we're paying people to remove carbon from the atmosphere. If you're excited about space, and this is why I'm going to lose some people, and you wanted to terraform Mars, you need the opposite system. You need the system that is paying people to create emissions so that Mars generates an atmosphere. And what does that look like? I don't know, but it's going to look a lot like, you know, protecting our planet today. It's going to look a lot like how do we provide those ecosystem services, and how do we compensate people for doing that beyond just it's the right thing to do or altruism. And so that's something that, like, if that's what gets people excited, you know, protect our current ecosystems. Absolutely. If it gets people excited about the future and making another habitable planet, then that's another place we can go. But we need systems for that.
Well said, Grant. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, your experience here on the program today. Fascinating work that you're doing. I think you educated a lot of people who will be curious about carbon markets and, of course, how to solve these existential issues that we have. In all of this, what is your definition of a real leader?
I'm a utilitarian. So greatest good for the greatest number of people. That can be codified into other mantras of people, product, profit, is one from Hard Thing About Hard Things, which is one of the books that was, you know, very instrumental to me in my journey.
Love that. For Grant Canary, I'm Kevin Edwards, asking you out there, think like a utilitarian and always keep it real. Thanks, Grant.
Hey, Real Leaders, thanks again for listening to this amazing episode. And if you're someone like me who goes all the way to the end just to make sure I can extract as much information, education, and inspiration out of every single interview, might I suggest you check out our magazine. If you go online to realleaders.com today, you're going to get the first 30 days for free, where you're going to be able to access all of our magazines, courses, and live events from some of the top thought leaders around the world. All you have to do is go online to realleaders.com and click the subscribe button in the top right corner to get your free 30-day trial right now. Again, that's real-leaders.com. Thanks again for being a real leader, and always keep it real.